We should probably start the show, shouldn't we?
What show?
Yeah. That thing that we accidentally made when we were talking about cars. We had a lot of really, 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 really awesome feedback about the last episode. And I don't say that to self-congratulate. What I mean is a lot of listeners wrote in various forms and tweets and emails and all sorts of things to say, not only that, you know, they like all of us and that they also enjoy the show. In particular, they enjoyed the end of the last show. And I don't know that us having group therapy sessions is really going to be entertaining on a regular basis, but I really appreciate, and I think I speak for the two of you guys as well, I really appreciate everyone that wrote in and said, keep on keeping on. So that was very kind of every single one of you, and I tried to reply to pretty much everyone that I saw, but if I missed you, my apologies, and thanks so much for having written in. That was really cool.
Yeah, definitely. We got a lot of great feedback about that, because I think a lot of people don't talk about this stuff in public on the internet because it doesn't fit into the topic of your site or your podcast. And this is true of lots of various human factors that just don't really get enough coverage. But, you know, the few times where you can get people to show you their more human side usually are pretty well received. And you know, we didn't, at least, we didn't do it to solicit or fish for compliments. We got a lot of compliments, and I'm very thankful for that. But
I was going to say it worked well that way, but that wasn't the point.
Right, that wasn't the intention. But we do appreciate what everyone's feedback, and it was very nice. So thank you.
Yeah, a lot of people also said that even though we said this really isn't on topic for the podcast or whatever, like, oh well, you know, but you should talk about it anyway because. And the same point a lot of them made was that, in particular, the technology market has difficulties with a lot of the issues we discussed, both, you know, personalities and technology, taking and receiving criticism and the whole angle on, you know, workplace problems and gender relations and the whole nine yards. It's true that is a problem in particular in the tech industry. I'm still not entirely sure it's on topic for a tech podcast. So, like, I know people are like, oh, well, then you should start a different podcast and talk about these things or whatever, but I think it's good to do once in a while, and I think that there is an angle on it. Like, if something related to those topics happens in the industry, that's how we find ourselves talking about it. We started off talking about the Penny Arcade thing, and just kind of drifted from there. And I think that's fine, but I'm not sure it should be like it really is going off the rails if you start making your podcast about that. That would be a perfectly good topic for another podcast, but we've all got enough podcasts here.
Well, plus, you know, if it isn't immediately clear to everybody, the three of us could talk about anything. So, you know, it doesn't, like, we could go off the rails in any possible direction very easily, so it's important that we at least try to keep ourselves somewhat on at least one topic per, or at least one genre of show while we're actually recording that show.
Something like that. All right, so yeah, so thanks again to everyone that wrote in. That was very kind of you. And even if you didn't write in, thanks for indulging us while we talked it out. Now, John, you seem to have, I'm assuming this was you, John, a lot of feedback about PrimeSense.
Yeah, last week we talked about Apple buying PrimeSense, which is a company that makes Kinect-like sensors, like the Xbox Kinect, and I still didn't even bother. Yeah, didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Didn't bother looking up what their relationship to the original Kinect was, whether they were the company that made the sensor, or whether they sold it to Microsoft, I don't know. But anyway, they make a Kinect-like sensor, and Apple bought them, and last week I said that the obvious idea would be that, Apple bought them, and that means they're going to use something like the Microsoft's Kinect on whatever their crazy TV thing is. And I said, what about if they use that same technology in an iOS device to do something less impressive? I said that not knowing that if you had just simply gone to the PrimeSense website, you would have seen on their listing of products that one of the products they offer is something that's sized meant to fit inside a tablet. So there you go. It's not a stretch. It's an existing product that is very small and could fit inside a tablet, and who knows what Apple bought them for. Like, but it's clear that this company could offer a lot of things to both Apple's current product lines and product lines that we all speculate that Apple may, or hell, even put something like that in a watch or whatever. And then I had some more info on the issues of this kind of technology. In particular, if you just look at what PrimeSense sensors are like and what Kinect sensors are like and say, could Apple use that type of thing in a television or in an iOS device? The problem with the iOS device angle is that both of the approaches that PrimeSense and the existing Kinect sensors use don't work very well outdoors. And iOS devices have to be able to, I mean, I don't know what percentage of time they spend indoors and outdoors, but enough time that if you have something that only works indoors, it's probably not viable for any iOS devices that Apple sells. And the problem with doing it outdoors is they both use infrared, and infrared outdoors can get washed out if it's a sunny day because the sun is going to have way more IR than anything that's put out by one of these devices or sensors. And one way to get around it is to really crank up the IR on the device, but that burns battery and could blind people if you, shined it in their face. So it's not a great solution there. And there's also the problem of what is the stereo distance between the sensors. You have to kind of pick, do you want it to be able to get depth information about things that are really close, like your finger on an iPad or something, or do you want it to be able to get stuff that's farther away? And there's some difficult trade-offs there. So anything that uses this kind of technology is probably going to be focused on an indoor application. But that's not to say that anything Apple is going to make with this company is going to have anything to do with any technology that we've already seen. This is just looking at what they have done. Who knows what they're going to do? And it's perfectly feasible that Apple might have bought them based on some technology that they had in the works that nobody's seen yet. So I don't know. It's a company to watch. It's like PA Semi, because it's interesting and exciting from a hardware angle, and software is a little bit more mutable. We'll talk about that a little bit later, I think. But when Apple buys a hardware company, you have to think that they bought them because they want to do something similar to what this company has done in hardware. They're not just buying it to get, oh, well, the, you know, you might buy a company to get a bunch of software developers. So we could put these guys to work at iOS. But if you buy people who make this kind of a sensor, you got to think they're doing something with some kind of weird sensor, right? So I'm excited by the possibilities of putting any kind of weird Kinect-like sensor in anything that Apple makes.
Yeah, it should be interesting, although certainly I can't conceive of what they're going to do with this. But that, just like you said, that's the beauty of it. Any other follow-up, you or Marco? Or Marco, do you just want to tell us about something that's awesome?
This episode is brought to you in part by our friends at Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Did they used to say in minutes at the end of that slogan? Or am I thinking of something else?
I don't recall.
I think it used to be in minutes. Anyway, it's really fast and easy.
Anything longer than a minute is technically in minutes, right?
Well, I mean, even I think anything that's not exactly 1 minute could be minutes.
There you go.
You know, if it's like 0.78 minutes, that's minutes. Just exactly 1.0, that's a minute. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use offer code ATP12. Squarespace is constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. They have beautiful designs for you to start with and all the style options you need to create a unique website for you or your business. Every design also automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your site, so your content will look great on every device every time with these responsive layouts. Squarespace is very easy to use, whether it takes minute or minutes. But if you need any help, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with over 70 full-time employees right here in New York City doing their support. Squarespace starts at just $8 a month, and it includes a free domain name if you sign up for a whole year up front. But you don't even need to. You can start a free trial with no credit card required. It's a real free trial, no obligation, no credit card required. And you can start building your website today. See if you like it. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use our offer code ATP12 to get 10% off your initial purchase and to show your support for our wonderful podcast. Squarespace is everything you need to create an exceptional website. And we thank them very much for their support. We use Squarespace, and we like it. You know, we have our show there. We did our previous show, Neutral. We have that site there. It's really great, really easy. You know, not everybody needs to write everything from scratch. And coming from me, that's kind of ridiculous to hear. But believe me, they do things that would take me writing from scratch years and years to do, and they do it in minutes. So it's really great. Thanks a lot to Squarespace for supporting our show. Don't forget, use coupon code ATP12.
Thought of a new Squarespace-based business plan. Find a business that you go to that you like, or it doesn't have to be a business that you like, but anything some like your barber or your landscaper or whatever, and you see that they have a website, but it's terrible. A new business idea is to fix people's terrible websites. They pay you, and then you take some of the money they paid you and pay it to Squarespace and just give them a Squarespace site, which takes you like 10 seconds of clicking. You're basically becoming like a Squarespace value-added reseller for people, because I always wonder why these people have such terrible websites when, like, for pocket change. Like, I know how much these landscapers make. They make plenty of money. or, you know, anybody, if you have enough money for any website, it's just these people's websites are terrible because they're not web designers. They don't know what they're doing. The websites look like they were made in 1992 and they have little, you know, animated men under, you know, men working construction, the image at the bottom of it and a website hit counter. It's like, geez, just get a Squarespace site. It's so easy and it will look better and everyone will be happier. And if you can facilitate that, then that's maybe a viable business.
This is like, you know, back in the the late 90s and early 2000s, there was this whole business, I guess there still is, this whole business of web hosting resellers. Like, this is, like, things like cPanel and stuff were developed not for one person running one server for themselves, but were developed for people who ran tons of sites on tons of different servers or tons of sites on one server for clients and charged them a big premium for that. And it seems like Squarespace has really kind of made that entire industry half obsolete.
Yeah, because nobody wants to use a cPanel interface. Are you kidding me? That is not anything that a regular... That's what kept regular people away, and they would pay some teenager to make their website, and that teenager would go away, and they'd be stuck with this website that they can never change. That's terrible and never gets any better, and yeah.
All right, so speaking of acquisitions, Apple is still up in buying things, and they bought Topsy, which I had never heard of before.
I'd heard the name before, but I didn't know what they did until I read the articles. Like, first of all, how does a company... I mean, I guess I understand how a company like this exists, but what did they get over? $200 million? Something like that?
I believe that's right.
So this is a company that none of us have really heard of, or maybe we heard the name or whatever. This company apparently existed as a way to mine data from the Twitter stream. So they would absorb all the tweets and they would sort of index them and allow people to do searches to find out what's going on Twitter and stuff. And I guess they resell this to people like advertisers who want to see what's trending, or like, it's a business. It's like B2B. It's not a consumer level business, because these people, as far as I know, did not make a company worth $200 million to Apple by selling services to individual customers. Right?
I believe that's right. I mean, from what very, very little I know about it, because I didn't do any research. But everything, I think that's right.
But the fact that they're so Twitter-focused is mysterious, because why would Apple buy a company so focused on a service they don't own, right? It's not like they bought a mapping company to help them with their maps. They don't have a Twitter equivalent. So what is a company that has expertise in mining the Twitter stream going to do for them? Do they have some other stream that they would like to point Topsy at and say, we would like you to extract information from this? Are they going to be collecting metrics from people wandering through the App Store? I don't know.
I mean, the price tag was a little high to be an acqui-hire, but I think, you know, Facebook and Google buy all sorts of crazy crap just to get talent in the door. You know, really, they're just buying the staff. That's you know, the acqui-hire phenomenon. Apple has a big problem that they have a real need for really good staff. And we can see a lot of the areas in which they are clearly short-staffed. You know, we see like a lot of the applications, like, you know, like I've said recently that I think their hardware is better than it's ever been right now, but their services have never been great and are still not great. And even their software is really starting to go into disrepair in a lot of different areas. I think the OS level stuff is rock solid. I think whoever they have working on the OS level teams, they clearly have great people and enough of them, I think. But it seems like the applications teams are really strained. And that's why you go, like, you know, you have all these years of iWork 09 followed by this new release of iWork that is really obviously unfinished, that was rushed out the door for other reasons, probably, you know, lining it up with the marketing of the new iPads and et cetera. But clearly Apple needs more people. They need more engineers. They need more staff. And they also have a bit of a retention problem, because from what I understand, this is purely anecdotal, but from what I understand, they lose a lot of really good people, because there's this whole world of apps and startups happening around them, around their own ecosystem that they've created, and their own employees can't participate in that while they're working for Apple. And so it's very tempting for their employees to be like, you know, now that I've been working, you know, supporting UIKit or apps or whatever for all these years, maybe I want to actually go make my app. And Apple has a pretty good policy about if you want to leave and then come back within a certain amount of time, you can, like, retain all your seniority and stuff. So, like, they have a problem getting people and retaining people.
Even more than going and making an app, imagine if you wanted to do independent consulting and you have Apple on your resume.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how that pretty much is the only entry you need on your resume if you're going to do either iOS or OS X development and consulting. Well, you know, what makes you think that you're so special and you're good at this? I used to work for Apple. Where do I sign? You know, I mean, right. it really opens a lot of doors having that on your resume.
Like, oh, I wrote iPhoto. You know,
like, exactly.
Or this API that everyone's coding against, I wrote the API. You know, that like that's so for Apple to buy a company like this, where it doesn't seem obvious to us what part of the company's product they might want. You know, $200 million is a lot of money for an acquihire, but maybe they had some really good people. You know, most acquihires are in like the 10 to 50 million range. But, you know, if they had a bunch of really good people, maybe that's worth it to them. And this is a large web service that was consuming the live Twitter feed, or the live Twitter fire hose, as they call it, which is kind of gross. But they were consuming that. Like, that's a large-scale web service operation. Apple needs a lot of help in large-scale web service operations.
Did you follow the second link I put underneath?
Of course not. I didn't do any research.
So the second link is a...
Oh, the Dalton one. Yeah, I did read that.
Yeah, I don't know if this is true or not, but Dalton of app.net fame says that as far as he knows, Topsy is a Perl company, as he calls it, meaning that they implement their web service in Perl. And for the most part, Apple does not know their Perl from their elbow. And so the expertise that the programmers in those companies might have in writing, you know, server-side applications in Perl, I can't imagine Apple thinking those particular technical skills are, you know, worth anything to them.
Well, that doesn't matter. When you're dealing at the scale that Topsy was dealing with, or the scale that Apple is dealing with or needs to be dealing with, the actual language that you're writing your application in really does not matter one bit. It's really much more about how you write it, how you use the resources of things like the database, the network, the cache layer, stuff like that. Like, it's how... It's such a bigger picture thing than just the language you use. It's like it doesn't matter what text editor you use to write a shell script. Like, it matters what it's doing. Similar, you know, when you get to a scale like what they're doing, you can do it in any language, really.
But when they do acquihires, I have to imagine, like, if they do acquihires of people who they know they want to put on the iOS team, they want the people who they hire, they could be app developers or whatever, but they want them to be Objective-C programmers because they're going to put you deep in the guts of Objective-C. Or if they're hiring someone for the core OS group, they want them to know C and BSD API specifically because that's where they're going to be. They're not just like, well, you've worked on some operating system. Like, I have to think that the technical skills are relevant when, in particular, doing acquihires. It seems to me that Topsy has... From the outside, it looks like Topsy has abilities that Apple wishes it had. Like, they consume the Twitter fire hose, and they get something out of it. And I think Apple has a very specific thing in mind, some big, giant stream of data that they want to feed into something and get useful information out of it. And it's high volume, and they need a company that can take a high volume stream of data and do something with it. So that seems... like the most likely thing. I just can't think of exactly which stream it is. I mean, there's many possible streams. They have all this activity of customers doing things, buying things in stores, rating applications, all that stuff. Hell, it could even be map data, someone to handle all of the feedback that we've all been putting into Apple Maps to say this thing is in the wrong place and we're frustrated that it doesn't result in action, you know, quickly. I don't know. This also, I think, may be hard to tell, like, with a sensor purchase, it'll be pretty obvious when we see something with some crazy sensor on it. We'll be like, oh, that was probably that crazy sensor company they bought. But with Topsy, it may be hard for us to tell what, you know, there may be no obvious moment where we say, oh, there must have been, well, that's why they hired Topsy to do this. It might not be obvious at all. In fact, it might be entirely for internally facing tools that they do for their own metrics that they never show anybody. So this is mysterious.
Also, you know, going back a half step to the web service thing, Apple's web services are still, in the grand scheme of things, young. And a lot of them are compartmentalized or outsourced. So if Apple wanted to build up a big service presence in-house, there's still a lot of room to start that, not quite from scratch, but close. Like, to really, like, get in on the ground floor and do that.
Yeah, they need to do that.
Right. And so if they... You know, just because these people built a really big volume web service using Perl that consumes the Twitter stream to get certain things out, Apple really might be using this just to, like, start another department or bring something that was outsourced in-house, you know, from some big thing they're already doing with a fresh new start, a fresh new team, or you know, not having outsourced for the first time. There's a lot of potential even for that. And, you know, we've been saying like every third week that Apple sucks at web services and needs to, you know, really take it to the next level and take it a lot more seriously and make it a bigger priority in the company. Maybe something like this is the start of that.
Maybe they get acqui-hire Microsoft to get the Azure team. Is that possible? Do we have to wait a couple more years?
But I think just a couple.
I don't know how many. We'll see.
Just hire Elop as the CEO, and then he'll make it really cheap for him.
Yeah, exactly.
So I wonder, though, if Topsy is about – what if it's about consuming Twitter data about Apple and not allowing competitors to use the same technology to look at –
It's the ultimate vanity search. Apple needs to know what are they saying about us on Twitter. Topsy, tell us.
That's actually exactly what I'm talking about. Like, to be honest, my first thought, which I'm a little mad at you, John, because you stole it from me before I had a chance to say it, was for internal use about like maybe the App Store or something like that, which you said a moment ago. But what if it is about the ultimate vanity search to see what, you know, Sam Cook loves his customer sat, which that abbreviation infuriates me. But
to be fair, I think he stopped saying that recently.
Oh, well, whatever. The customer satisfaction numbers. I mean, Tim Cook loves his customer satisfaction numbers.
But they're already getting those numbers. I have to think that there is nothing that Apple cares about what its customers think $200 million worth. Like, seriously. Like, that's always been the attitude of the company is we accept feedback from customers to get a feel for what's out there. But in general, they think it's their job to show us what it is that we want rather than just asking what we want and trying to build that. Like, that's always been the company's MO, and that's what we like about them. So I can't imagine an entirely, like, oh, we need to figure out what's out there about Apple or about Apple customers $200 million worth. Like, because the Twitter fire hose is way more volume than – you just need to sample users, right? Whereas if you want to get – I don't think they're sampling the fire hose. I think they're consuming it all and indexing it and all that stuff, which is very different than – surveying customers and seeing how your satisfaction is. I have to think they have things in place for all of the sort of market research feedback about what's needing to get repair, what are people unsatisfied about, all that stuff. Like, that has to already be in place. It doesn't seem like that's a problem area for Apple.
Well, also, that's not incredibly unique to Topsy. Like, there have been multiple companies that have over the last, you know, 5 years, multiple people who have come up who take the Twitter fire hose and parse stuff out of it. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do, but it's certainly not unique to this one particular company that no one else will ever be able to do it again.
Twitter bought one of them, didn't they? Didn't they buy Sumly or something? Not the other. There was some other.
Sumeyes is what you're talking about. That was a long time ago, and that is what became Twitter Search.
Yeah, I know, but that was always funny though, because like Twitter was creating the data, and they had to buy an outside company to be able to search that. It was Twitter. Remember when Twitter Search sucked?
Mm-hmm.
Twitter is actually a good success story for a company that didn't know how to make wide scale web services and figured it out. Because Twitter in the beginning had an idea. They had Ruby on Rails. They had, I'm assuming, hipsters in San Francisco or whatever it is they need. And like, but then they ran into the giant, you know, avalanche of users. And then they had problems and problems and problems. And they figured, you know, I mean, that's kind of the natural arc of any startup. Like, you try to build something, you really hope somebody likes it. Then all of a sudden the users come and you're like excited. Then more users come and you're a little bit scared. And then you have to figure it out. And they did, barely. I would say that Twitter came the closest to a company that was crushed by its own success in terms of not being able to handle the traffic. If they had anything close to a viable competitor that like had the mind share they had, they could have just as easily gone down as a footnote of like that company that we thought was going to be big but couldn't keep their stuff together, and some other company stole their bacon. But it turns out they ended up getting enough mind share soon enough that we all just tolerated their terrible problems. And now they've come out of it and they're so much bigger, handling volumes that would have made the head spin back in the, you know, 2006, 2007 days. So if Twitter can do it, coming from essentially nothing to a world-class web service that does incredible volumes, again, surely Apple can, right? And we say this every, you know, it seems like they got all the money in the world. Why can't they get their stuff together? I don't know.
Right, and it's really about priorities, I think, and culture, and it, you know, they're such a big company that they need to make significant changes from the top to the bottom. You know, like they need somebody at the senior VP level whose only job it is to do stuff like this, and don't they kind of, isn't that like half of somebody's job up there? Is it Eddie Q?
I thought so.
Eddie Q is in charge of services or something like that. Some umbrella term like that. He's basically in charge of the iTunes store and I think all of their like web service-y type things.
Do you think he needs to be replaced?
It's so hard. You can't play politics with that.
Is it not his problem? Is it like, you know, is it that does he have an impossible job?
Isn't Q in charge of scoring licensing deals and things of that nature? Didn't he kind of become the de facto guy to do that?
I think so. That's certainly what we've heard.
Yeah, he's always been like the iTunes store. He was part of the content deals and everything like that. But
right.
Right, so maybe the problem is he has too much to do.
That's exactly what I was driving at, is maybe he's so busy working on content deals, perhaps for the Apple TV or whatever. But one way or another, perhaps he's too busy worrying about all of that, and he doesn't have enough time to worry about services, or not as much time as he'd like.
Yeah, and every company I've been in, there's one group in the company that sort of wears the pants. And a lot of times, but not always, it's the group that originally made the thing that made the company successful and, you know, made the company what it is today. And at Apple, it seems like the group that has that power is, I mean, I don't know what the balance is between hardware and software. It's basically the people who work directly on whatever the flagship product is. So you made the operating system for the Macintosh, you made the hardware for the Macintosh. That's the tail that wags the dog. And there's tons of other people in the company, but they're more or less running the show. And that's fine when your company makes devices with hardware and software. Shouldn't the people running the show who make all the great hardware and software that makes your company successful? But now you throw the services thing into the mix, and I have to think that they are sort of the, you know, redheaded stepchild of the company, where we're writing software too, but your software is not iOS. Your software is not OS X. Your software is just something that runs on a server, and we only care about you when you screw up. There's no glory in your job. Just get it done. You're about as important to our company as the people who keep our mail servers running, right? And that culture that they're the B team and they're not as important to the company is really difficult to overcome. Even with leadership at the top saying we're rededicating to services, iCloud is a big deal. I don't know if they can get the best people, the most money, the priorities, the attention from everybody. Because everyone is so focused on what's the next iPhone, what's the next version of iOS, iOS 7 and the iPhone 5S, right? Whole company's focused on that, launch, launch, launch. And by the way, the services better work, but we don't want to hear about it. Like, again, this is all from the outside. I don't know if this is true, but it's very difficult to change that internal culture that the iOS and the, you know, the hardware and software guys who make the flagship product are, that those are the glory jobs. And at Google, the glory jobs are the guys who run the search engine. Right, who run the web services, who index the entire web every 10 seconds or whatever the heck they're up to now.
Well, the guys who serve the ads, at least.
That's the glory job in Google, yeah. Or the ad, you know, the thing that serves the ads, right, that makes the money for the company. Like, but it's not, the glory teams at Google are not the teams that make, I think it's not even the teams that make Android or the Android devices at this point. It's the web services, and I think the real heart, if you dig down, the real heart of Google are the people who run the infrastructure that run all their services. Those are the real sort of the little Yodas inside Google, the people with the most respect and clout and power, the ability to say no to your project and yes to your project indirectly by, I mean, they make the services that make everything run. And that is a very different location than the heart of Apple's company, which is probably like a couple people in Johnny Ive's industrial design team and like the people who really run the core OS and who decide, I guess probably like the compiler team and maybe like the frameworks team for UIKit. Like that's the tiny little heart of Apple. And it is so distant from the heart of Google. And I don't know how, if you can have two hearts or if you could spread the company out or...
Sounds complicated.
Yeah, it's timey-wimey.
If you're one of the iOS or OS X engineers and you know enough about Apple to know that you are currently in the chosen one position, you're working on UIKit, you know you have your future paved ahead of you in a good way. Well, you're not going to be volunteering for going to work on iCloud. So anyone who's already there that's proven themselves probably is going to try to dodge the services bullet. Maybe that's what this Topsy thing is all about, and I'm reaching quite a bit here, but maybe the answer is you get a group that's really good at services, and again, Topsy is a dodgy example, but get a group that's really good at services, say Dropbox, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when it was even reasonable that they would be bought, and have them come in, and they're not as bitter and jaded about not being on UIKit yet, And maybe that's what it takes to get services to be at a position that it's not a piece of crap.
You missed the most important part about this Topsy acquisition, which is that if they hire this company and do not immediately throw away all of their technology, like that's not their plan, finally, there is a job inside Apple that I might be qualified for.
So let me know when you send your application in. I'll be a reference for you, John.
Yeah. No, I can only imagine interviewing there.
But you would have to move. You wouldn't move away from the greater Boston area, would you?
No, I think is part of their hiring problem, actually, because so many companies are flexible about remote workers now, and Apple historically has not been the most flexible company about remote work. And I guess Yahoo's going in the other direction as well, trying to lock things down there. But it's really difficult if we would like to hire you, but that would mean you'd have to move to one of the most expensive places to live in the country, and maybe your family's not near here, and that sort of... not artificially limits, it's kind of a natural limit, but it's difficult when you're, you know, the biggest or second biggest company in the world, that your requirement is everyone who works for me has to live around here. You're going to miss out on tons and tons of good people.
Yeah, and anecdotally, I've heard at least a couple of stories about people who have interviewed at Apple, perhaps even been offered a job at Apple, but have had to say, well, I really can't or won't move to California, at which point the conversation's over.
And there are other places, like Google has offices. Google has an office in Boston. They have a big office in New York City. Amazon has offices in not just in Seattle. They have on the East Coast as well. Like, and Apple, I think, does have some offices in Austin, and like that one guy who makes all the money in Ireland. And like they have remote locations, but the heart is really, you know, the giant flying saucer thing that they're building, and you know, one infinite loop. So if that is a possible way forward for Apple, and I would think that they were looking at that. To have a substantial presence, like to not say that everything has to happen in California for our important products, of course. You know, and maybe that's a way for the server side group to get some freedom from that, is make the server side groups based, you know, in Texas or on the East Coast somewhere. So just so they can be independent. And then maybe you can build up a group there that sort of has its own pride and reputation and isn't constantly overshadowed by, you know, iOS and Johnny Ive's hardware and all that stuff.
This episode is also brought to you by our friends at Igloo Software. Igloo, this is great. So if you go to igloosoftware.com/ATP, you'll see this new landing page they made. And a couple episodes ago, we were talking about enterprise software and how awful it is, and John's enterprise software assumptions, and how John had such an ordeal with the Cisco VPN stuff on Mavericks. Igloo, because they actually listen to our cool stuff, and actually, you know, our fans and support us for a very long time now, Igloo has made a page in response to John's myths about enterprise software. it's pretty great. So go to igloosoftware.com/ATP to see.
I have not seen this yet up until just this very moment, and this is utterly fantastic.
Isn't it great? Like, usually on their landing pages, they'll sneak in, like, an inside reference or two. Like, you know, you'll catch them, like, subtly. This time they went all out. It's pretty great. So Igloo's latest cloud update, Tinsel, arrives this Friday, which is probably going to be the release date of this show. So let's say today. It's a free update for every customer. When you log into your Igloo, the new features are immediately available starting this Friday. With Tinsel, Igloo is making it easier than ever for you to get started. Some company... oh, we should point out before I do this, they didn't tell me to say this, but I probably should tell you what Igloo actually is before I go on about their latest update. Igloo is a hosted, enterprise-ready intranet software platform that doesn't actually suck. That's not their official tagline, that's my tagline for them, but it's basically an intranet that doesn't suck. So they have great design, and they have things like Twitter-like things, microblogs, wikis, all sorts of components that they can use for your company to use internally, and they're all private and encrypted and secure and everything. But, you know, so they aren't out there on the public internet, so, you know, that's very nice for companies, but it also is not horrible, ugly, clunky, feature-limited enterprise software from the 90s. With Tinsel, Igloo's making it easier than ever for you to get started. Some companies don't need a full intranet. Now you can start your Igloo with just one of their web apps. Like, for example, if you just need file sharing or you just need microblogs by themselves. The best part is you can still add additional apps into your Igloo, expanding it later as your needs grow. So if you start with file sharing to replace Dropbox, for instance, you can add an internal blog and shared calendars later, all in one place. Tinsel also adds a health check dashboard for your intranet. It gives you detailed analytics into easy-to-read these charts about the people, content, and social activity happening in your intranet. When your intranet falls below Igloo's benchmark data, suggestions appear in the health check dashboard to improve your performance. There's also great new features like content templates, color-coded channels, new widgets, and more. So start building your Igloo today. It's free to use up to 10 people and very affordable after that. So go to igloosoftware.com/ATP to see this great page they made for us and to sign up. Thanks a lot to Igloo for sponsoring our show.
This is a great landing page, and I immediately scrolled to the bottom to see if they were going to do item number 4, because it was my, I forget what they called it, enterprise software.
Assumptions, I think?
Yeah, yeah, basically. And the first 3 were easy. It's like, you know, when a new version of OS 10 comes out, assume your enterprise software won't work. So they're going to contradict that and say, well, Igloo will work, right? And so on and so forth. But the 4th one was actually, despite all the terribleness of enterprise software, sometimes it's your fault. And I'm like, well, how are they going to spin that one? So they say, despite all the terrible things that are terrible about enterprise software, it's at least partially your fault. And then they added in parentheses, but we'll help you fix it. So they turned it into a customer service angle. If you do something, if you screw up, Igloo is there to help you out. So that's very clever. And the little paragraphs of text they wrote underneath each one of these things, it's very nice. And I totally agree with it, because Igloo is the internet that I wish I could use, but don't.
And I have to point out just a couple of quick items here. At the bottom of number 1, and just for John, Flash is optional and there are 0 apps required.
0 Java apps required.
Sorry. And the, quote, and just for John part, quote, I pulled directly off the page, which is pretty awesome. And then I also enjoy way towards the bottom, collaboration doesn't have to be craziness. Watch our sandwich videos and save yourself from SharePoint, which is pretty awesome. And that's dear to my heart.
Yeah, these guys really get it. So thanks a lot to Igloo. Man, speaking of it's sometimes your problem, about a week ago, I, for the second time, you would think this would only happen to a geek like me once, but no, for the second time, I called Verizon Fios to report an outage, and the problem was that I had to reboot my own Apple Airport Extreme.
Did they tell you to do the thing where I just plug it and unplug it in case any dust settled on it in the Merlin parlance?
No, they didn't make up any kind, you know, merciful reasons to make me do that. They're like, oh, have you tried rebooting it? And of course, immediately I'm like, oh yeah, I think I've tried that. I must have tried that. And then I'm like, you know what? Let me go try it just in case. And this actually happened like 6 months ago. Also, I was so embarrassed, like, because our Fios has not been that reliable. Actually, about 2 days ago, it had a real outage, like all night, and it was pretty rough. So I've called them, like, over the course of having it for the last 3 years, I've called them maybe 5 times about outages, and 2 of them have been, I just needed to reboot my own router that I use, arrogantly not using theirs.
I'm really terrified to replace my Apple Airport. I have, like, an Airport Extreme, like, when they were the flat pancake thing, and actually a much older model. And it's not good. It doesn't have good Wi-Fi range, but it is rock solid. Like, I have had to plug it and unplug it. Sometimes, like, I'll go away for vacation or something, but, like, maybe 2 times a year I have to do that. And it doesn't crash. It doesn't reboot. It just runs and runs and runs. And every other router that I read about, it's like, oh, I have to, you know, reboot it once a week, or it's flaky, or sometimes it just stops sending data or whatever. And that's why I'm so, and also I'm using it instead of using any Fios hardware. I go right from the ONT into my thing, and I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to get it to release the IP address. So when I plug in the new one, it won't be able to get, like,
oh yeah, you have to call them to do that. There's all these tricks on the internet about, like, oh, well, if you hold down the buttons on the ONT and make it do a real full reset, and it never works. Like, it's held for, I think, at least a few hours. On the server end.
I'm willing to wait a few hours. When I did the switchover, the guy who did my install was good, and I told him what I was planning on doing, and he, of course, has to hook up the Verizon whatever, and he just basically said, you should go to the admin interface to this router, and you can issue a command to have it release the IP. So issue the command to have it to release the IP, and then disconnect that router, and then the next router you connect, it will give the IP. And so I didn't have to wait an hour for it. But yeah, I'm so scared to get rid of this router, even though it has such terrible range, because I hate the stupid giant TARDIS looking thing from Apple that it has the fan inside it, which I don't want, and B, any other choice that I have, I'm terrified that it's going to be flaky and reboot all the time.
I'm just surprised that you got asked to do all those sorts of things, because I don't remember if I talked about this on the show, and cut me off if I did, but a week or two ago we had an outage, and it, long story short, it was because of a power spike in the box that's in the garage, which isn't the ONT. It's like the power station that powers the ONT, ended up getting fried. But I called them at like 9 o'clock at night. And I called Verizon. I said, hey, you know, I have an outage, and here's what I've discovered. Not only is the internet out, but the phone and the TV are out. And the only slightly weird thing they had me do was unplug this little power station, as I call it. And I know that's not the right term. And plug in anything else into that outlet just to make sure the outlet was alive, which I thought was completely reasonable. And that was the only thing. Never asked about a router, never asked about anything else. That was the only thing they did. And then, sure enough, at 8:30 the next morning, somebody arrived to fix it. And by no later than 9 o'clock, it was already fixed. And that was the only that was the second time I've had somebody to the house about my Fios service since 2008.
I will say also, like, they, I've had amazing luck with the people that you get when you call them for tech support. Like, they're really consistently really good people, and like they do. I think you got the effect of this. They do pick up pretty quickly whether you're a geek or not. You don't have to like try to convince them. Yes, I know what I'm talking about generally, although I haven't tried rebooting my router. But you know, you don't. You don't usually have to go, you know, jump through hoops. Yes, I'm plugging it in now. You know, fake it. You don't have to do that. You can just tell them, hey, you know, my ONT is failing, and like the fact that you know what it's called will probably get them to immediately say, okay, here, you do this and this, and then that's it. They're really good. They're very geek friendly.
Right. As soon as I said ONT, I think that flipped the switch into this person must at least know slightly what they're talking about.
This person at least read a forum once.
Right. Exactly. So this episode is sponsored by Verizon.
Right. Going back a minute, back to Apple and their potential woes with services and the respect within the company. How much of this do you think is a problem with the release and marketing schedule? So when most people do web services, Google included, everyone, you know, Facebook, Twitter, everything, they don't usually have big press events to announce feature updates. You know, they new products maybe, but generally like a feature update or like, you know, a medium scale improvement won't really get a big event, and they won't hold it for a big event. Whereas Apple almost always does that. Like their web services seem to almost be versioned and fixed in time as if they were OSs or, you know, the OS updates that we get, where like they will hold back certain features or fixes or tweaks until the next marketing event to lump it all in. And part of that is, I think, necessary because Apple has been battling this image that they're not innovating anymore. So they probably feel pressure to like pump up their events with as much crap as they can cram in there with all this cool stuff they've been doing. But I think that ultimately is really dysfunctional for web services and web apps, because that's not how the rest of the world works. That's not how the web works. And like how much of their problem stuff in this area do you think is related to that kind of forced product marketing schedule that both the public and Apple kind of forces on itself?
The good and the bad part of it is that the web services are not held in high enough esteem to be deemed worthy of holding back for the thing. Like, remember they're doing the iCloud beta website? No, I work for iCloud or whatever the hell those terrible web services were. They put that out and they revised it and they improved it and it was like up for beta, and then they rolled it out to everybody, and like they'll do, because it's not a big deal and they don't think it's going to be that flashy. And though they did demo it at the recent event, they had been making changes and improvements to it. I mean, just think of the whole history of that interface that they've had that's supposed to look like Apple Mail. They changed that and improved that off cycle, like not during events, because it's like, well, they don't think it's high enough priority for an event, because it's not going to be impressive or it's not their bread and butter. And I know they do want to have a big bang and tie it in with the new versions of the iLife applications, but it's like they get to be in the presentation only because they're tied to one of the real products that Apple makes. And the rest of the time, they'll willingly update it and tweak it and do stuff to it. I mean, it seems like they're better for not being tied to that schedule, but inevitably for all of their products, they're going to have to. They do a pretty good job dealing with it. With the exception of hardware, they're going to have to get used to putting out products on a less monolithic kind of schedule and more kind of in dribs and drabs. And I think they are getting better about that. Like when they have to, for example, the mail update to work with the Gmail stuff, you got to do what you got to do. That didn't come in 10.9.1. The old Apple would have held that for 10.9.1. But in the new era of, you know, people trying to use it in web services and Gmail to get their work done, you can't hold that for 10.9.1. 10.9.1 is not ready to come out. It's coming, but they can't hold the mail fix, so it has to come out. And same thing if there was a Safari error or whatever. You just got to keep pushing these updates. And I think the change in Mavericks to having optionally automatic updates of all applications on the OS is all part of that. Hardware is different because you have to make millions of these hardware devices in the months leading up to your launch, and it's kind of hard to avoid a big run-up to a big bang and then sell a couple million on a weekend. You can't let that out by drips and drabs. So I think the hardware stuff will still be on that schedule, and as long as any hardware stuff is on that kind of schedule, which I think makes sense if you want to have a big sort of opening weekend in movie parlance, there's some software that's tied to that hardware too, and there's no avoiding tying something to it. But the web services, for good or for ill, seem less tied to the hardware and more likely to be updated off-cycle.
This kind of reminds me, in a weird way, of companies that say they use agile processes but don't. And Marco, you will know nothing about this because you don't have a real job. But
you are correct.
But John, you might actually know something about this. So I've worked at a couple different places, and for most of my career, I've done consulting. And the place in which I work now actually does do legitimate, honest-to-goodness, agile development. And there's not an overabundance of planning up front. There's just enough to get by. And generally speaking, we manage all of our projects in terms of sprints. We use Pivotal Tracker. Everything gets assigned points. Points are used as currency. We cooperate with product owners about what to schedule, when to schedule it, et cetera, et cetera. And it actually works pretty well. And when everyone is on the same page, when the product owner is invested, when the product owner understands what a point is and what it represents, it works really, 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 really well. But if there's any weak link in that system, if, for example, the product owner, which is typically at the client, if the product owner doesn't have the time to invest or doesn't really care or doesn't want to learn to understand, then suddenly everything stops working well. And I kind of wonder, to bring this back to Apple, if even if the web services teams were behaving in such a way that they could do incremental releases regularly, I wonder if the superiors just kind of find that prohibitive. And I guess, Marco, this is kind of what you were saying as well. But even if they themselves were prepped for really frequent releases, I don't know that even if the higher-ups in Apple wanted them to do those more frequent releases, because so much of the company is based on annual or semi-annual releases, I don't know that it will ever really work, because it's kind of like trying to force Agile on a situation where Agile just doesn't really fit.
It made me depressed about Agile methodologies and other methodologies that are used in jobs. We should put that on the topic list for future podcasts, because that stuff makes me sad.
Wait, the fact that you don't use Agile?
No, all those kind of, like, here's a set of rules, and if you apply these rules, it will make you be able to develop software.
Can I make a slight confession?
Sure.
I have never used a methodology.
You're using one. It just doesn't have a name.
Yeah, exactly. It isn't that effective. I wouldn't recommend my methodology.
Most importantly, you're not using one imposed on you by somebody else. That is, no matter what methodology you're using, if you got to pick it, well, then, you know, it's very different than if a bunch of other people have decided this is the way we're going to develop software, and then you come into that environment and have the rules applied to you. That is a very different, whatever the rules are, that is very different.
Now, John, does your company self-describe as adhering to any particular methodology?
We use a lot of the words from Agile methodology.
But and hold on. So you self-describe as Agile. Now, I'm not asking what you are.
No. I don't think so. I don't think the company would say we use, because every time, you know, in interviews and stuff, we say we use aspects of an Agile system. And I would modify that to say we use vocabulary from an Agile system, which is what it devolves to. But
sure.
Yeah. Again, I think that's. I'm gonna put that on the topic list for another day, because I think it's a big long thing.
Right. We would never start a big long topic an hour into a show.
No, definitely not. All right. So I will let you slide on this one, but we will add it to the show notes that don't exist.
Type it in the notes file, yeah.
All right. Do you want to talk about this boring USB plug instead of interesting things like Agile?
This thing is pretty funny. So the USB 3.0 mini plug is a disaster, as we've talked about before. I have that card reader, my one USB 3 device. I still insert the plug wrong every time. Like, it's so weird to get that stupid mini 3 connector. Anyway, so the news is that the USB standards group or whatever has agreed to make a new connector that they haven't actually shown yet, but it's going to be a new connector that, like the Apple Lightning connector, will finally be reversible. And this will come out, if all goes to plan, which of course rarely happens with committees, if all goes to plan, devices that use this will come out in about 2016. Did I get that right?
If you were looking at the notes file, you would know.
That's in the different tab. Give me a break.
I thought it was 2015. Yeah,
the final specification is expected to be published by the middle of 2014. That's when the spec will be done, and then it presumably... But the thing is, with these specs, kind of like the 802.11 specs, there's a possibility that manufacturers will start building things to the not technically ratified or whatever approved spec, like they always
do.
Like
the draft N.
Yeah, I mean, they can always upgrade the firmware, but a lot of times they don't even have to do that. With controllers, with connectors, it might be a little bit more dangerous, but I don't know. But anyway, I would expect that the MO for the group that handles USB seems to be to make sure that whatever crap they come up with, you can make it as cheaply as possible. And that seems to be their one and only criteria for success, because they sure as hell don't care about making a good connector. And so this would be a change. This would be a change in methodology, but their audience is still the same group of people saying, how many pennies can we save by making a piece of crap connector? Can I bend a piece of metal into a shoebox shape? Good. Ship it. Done. Piece of plastic in the middle of a bent piece of metal.
Well, and to some extent, they should be concerned about that, because that's one of the things that has made USB so, you know, to reuse part of its acronym, so universal, that when USB first came out, you had like USB versus, you know, the old stuff, serial, parallel. But then FireWire came out, I think, soon afterwards or right before, and USB was always way cheaper to implement than FireWire. And part of this is, you know, the controller chips and how that's arranged, but USB was always the cheap way to go, and so it caught on like crazy because it was just the cheapest. And same thing now. You know, Thunderbolt comes for FireWire 800 comes out, USB 2.0 comes out. Thunderbolt comes out, USB 3.0 comes out. In every one of these generations, USB has dominated and won and been way more universal and supported than the other thing, because it's just cheap and it's simpler. Right? It's cheaper for everyone, cheaper to implement, cheaper to host, etc. So that actually does matter here. And I don't know how much of the total cost of implementation is like the bits on the connector versus the controller chips and the logic inside. But I would imagine a reversible connector with enough pins to support these kind of rates and everything else they have to support in the physical cable, a reversible connector is definitely going to be more expensive and more complicated to implement.
I'm not saying that the cheapness is not something they should go for. They just got the balance way off. Because, like, it's getting back to last show, penny wise, pound foolish. Oh, we can save tiny pennies by making our connector really crappy and cheap and easy to construct. The big win was over FireWire and stuff like that was that the smarts had to be in the computer. You didn't have to have like a complicated controller chip. Whereas FireWire interfaces were smart enough to sort of talk amongst themselves without a controlling computer. That's where all the money went. And they were like, oh, but no, like the mindset is just squeeze every penny you can out of these stupid connectors and ignore everything else and just shift that a little bit to say make them cheap. That's good, right? But it's like optimizing something. You have to profile it, find out where most of the time is being spent, optimize that part. So profiling USB is like, where's all the money being spent? Well, it's the stupid silicon chips in the controller. We can't afford a big, expensive controller like the FireWire things. We want to make a cheap controller that's easy to make, that can come from tons of manufacturers. That's good. Once you've done that, don't worry so much about the connector, because what portion of the price is the connector? Maybe it's an increasing portion as the silicon price goes to zero as we keep shrinking things. I don't know, but it's just such an incredible mistake. I always talk about that, you know, the USB connector guy saying, how does he know whether he did a good job? If any of us were making a connector, we would spend 10 minutes thinking about what makes a good connector, and surely we would come upon things like, hard to put it, can't put it in the wrong way, not externally symmetrical and internally asymmetrical. Like, those would come up if you just thought about it for a minute. And it's such a, like, on the one hand, you can say, well, if I save one penny, I end up saving $5 billion over the life of a thing because of so many USB connectors, right? But on the other hand, if you annoy people for 1 second, you annoy people for 5 billion seconds of the life. You know, it's just a different way of looking at it. So this gives me hope. And what I would like to see out of this, which I think would be hilarious, is if this new USB connector, of which there are no pictures or design drawings as far as I've been able to find, if this connector looks exactly like a Lightning connector, but like slightly different, like a little bit wider, or like has a bulge in it or something. Because think about it, what other kind of form factors can you get for a small connector that's not that giant, wide, floppy USB micro thing that's not even very micro? It has to be small. It's the whole point of the thing, because devices are getting smaller. And you want something small and reversible. It's very difficult to do something sturdy at that size. You know, just look at the existing, like the ones that go into your cameras, whatever the hell those connectors are. They're terrible.
Yeah, the micro USB, yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of different ones. There's one that looks kind of like it's got a wide, angled sort of triangular trapezoid thing on the bottom, then a rectangle. Then there's the one that's just skinny, and it looks almost like it's just exactly rectangular, but it's got like the corners chopped off of it.
I believe you're talking about mini and micro USB, respectively.
I don't know what the names are. They're both very small. But those are bent metal things, and inside the metal, it's like hollow, and there's pins in there, whereas the Lightning is reversed. It's like a solid piece of, well, not really solid, but it's solid, and then the connectors are on, the contacts are on the outside of the solid thing. And I think that's the only way, really, to make a sturdy, very small, reversible connector, because you can't have anything go inside the tiny little thing. Like, that's what makes the micro and mini so annoying, that there is that hollow spot that stuff has to go into. And you could make that reversible, I suppose, but I really, really hope that they basically just copy Lightning and say, reverse it, contacts on outside, solid middle, solid metal-ish thing, because then you can make that solid metal thing pretty thin and still be sturdy and still be reversible. So we'll see.
But the problem with Lightning, you know, the reason why Apple, and by the way, there was a great post John Gruber wrote on Daring Fireball about this thing today. We'll link to it in the show notes. About how this is like Lightning is like what makes Apple Apple, and it's everything that people love and hate about Apple. It's fantastic. But you know, in order to do this, you have to give up substantial concessions to complexity and cost. You know, to make something reversible, it is going to be more expensive. It is going to be much more complex, and you're going to have the dollar cables at from Monoprice might actually suck or might not work. Like there's gonna be problems.
You don't need as many contacts. A Lightning is expensive because it's meant to do more than just be USB. Like if it was just USB, they would just be running USB over it. Lightning does not just run USB over it. Like Lightning is Apple's expansion plan for their iOS devices, so that, you know, it's part of their how can we evolve our hardware without having to change this connector again. It's very flexible, very complicated. They just basically need to run USB over a cable with a different connector.
Well, but I think, well, physically, I'm pretty sure that the Lightning cable has like just barely enough contacts to run USB 3 over it and pull that off.
Yeah, but it's like this flexible arrangement where it can change what the pins do and they sense each other. Like it's way
right,
more expensive.
It's, like in
it's
software.
Way more expensive than, yeah, it's way more expensive than USB is going to be. But I think like just physically speaking, like, you know, ignore what's going over the wires and what's talking amongst them. Just look at the little metal thing that you plug into some other thing. I think the USB group can come up with a connector that's more expensive than any of their existing connectors, but is not outrageously so. And then down the line, continue, you know, as the wires connect, they connect to a USB 3 hub and they have all the same, you know, cost constraints that they always have there. I hope they can pull it off.
I love, too, how this is one of those things, like, about half the articles about it and a lot of the comments that some of the reporters are getting from the various USB spec people and from Intel and everything like that. It's so funny how they try to avoid talking about Apple or giving Apple any credit whatsoever in starting this thing. It's like they'll be like, well, we're designing this for emerging product categories. Well, I think they've already emerged a couple of years ago, actually.
I mean, and the worst thing about it is that USB was way out ahead in making connectors for very tiny devices. Like all those two terrible camera connectors that we were just talking about, those existed way before Lightning. Like the USB group saw people want to connect their cameras, or they're very small. I don't know if they had tablets or smartphones or whatever, charger. Like they said, they saw the need for small connectors way before Apple did. Apple took so long with that stupid giant, you know, 30-pin connector. they just, the USB group just made a series of terrible small connectors, right? And like, they were the, they had all the advantages of the old world PC. If we can move fast, we can fill needs as soon as we see them. And they just did a bad job in every single one of them. And so now they've sort of been embarrassed into this press release by Apple taking forever to come up with anything. But when they came up with it, it's fantastic, at least for Apple's purposes. Obviously, it wouldn't be fantastic for their group, for, you know, the expensive Lightning interface that connects to it. And so that's why it's so hard to envision this new USB thing being anything other than looking a lot like the Lightning connector, unless it's terrible. Because if they just make something that's like micro USB but a slightly different shape and reversible, I don't think that's a win. Like, would you rather plug in, say you took micro USB and now it's reversible, would you enjoy plugging that in? Nope. I sure as heck would, and I hate plugging that thing into my camera. It's not, you know, it's not a good experience. And so this is a test of whatever this is, the USB IF. I don't know what the IF stands for, but we'll see if they got their act together by what this connector looks like when it comes out.
Yeah, I'm very curious, honestly. I'm also, and I would love for them to do this on both ends of the cable. And I don't know if they would ever do that. USB has never had a symmetrical cable like that. But I would love to see that, because certainly the computer end of the cables is just as frustrating to insert, and you know, to insert upside down and everything. It's just as bad.
That's one of the things they say in the thing. Usability enhancements. Users will no longer need to be concerned with plug orientation / cable direction.
Oh, good.
Make it easier to plug in.
That would be fantastic.
And this will affect all of our lives, because even though we have Apple devices, we have cameras and stuff too, and they will have whatever this connector is in a couple of years, you have to assume, right?
And the Apple laptops and Apple computers that have USB, which is all of them, you know, those ports can get smaller too.
That may wait several more years. Remember how long it took Apple to get USB 3?
That's true. Maybe in 17 years, the Mac Pro will finally support these connectors.
That's where we're going to connect our Retina displays to our Mac Pros with this new USB connector, because DisplayPort will never carry appropriate resolutions.
Do you want to talk about anything else that's awesome? And then
let's go with our friends at Hover. Go to hover.com/ATP. Hover is high-quality, no-hassle domain name registration. Use promo code ATP for 10% off anything you buy. Hover takes all the hassle and friction out of owning and managing domain names. They offer smart, easy-to-use, and powerful domain name management tools. They believe that everyone should be able to take control of their online identity, have your own domain name, and they will make it easy for you to do so. They're part of 2Cows. 2Cows has been around since 1994. They also are the parent company of our previous sponsor, Ting, which is awesome. And they are one of the largest domain registrars in the world. Hover offers .net, co, com, TV, lots of different country codes, and many more top-level domains. They recently added a bunch of new ones, including .io, and they're always adding more. So you can get .dot just about anything at Hover. They don't believe in heavy-handed upselling or aggressive cross-selling, which is unusual in this business. They don't believe in hiding functionality or requiring extra payment for things that should be included with domain name management, such as who is privacy, subdomains, and URL forwarding. Hover Email also makes it easy and affordable to create a memorable email address and eschew the impersonal free webmail email addresses that you get from the webmail services. They also support Google Apps for Business. You can now add any Hover domain, new or old, to Google Apps for Business, and they will fully support that. Now, they offer, speaking of support, they offer excellent online help. But they also have an amazing phone support policy. You can call them up, this 800 number, Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern, and a live human being will pick up the phone and talk to you. And the person who picks up the phone actually has the power to help you. This is shockingly unusual in customer service these days. Hover actually supports this. You call up a phone number and talk to a human. They are really quite good, and I've done this a couple times to do a couple things, and there it's... It really is true. It's really fantastic. They also have this awesome, I believe they call it a domain name transfer valet service. Do I have that right? The valet service? Anyway, they have this great service where if you're moving a bunch of names to Hover and you don't want to have to go in and log into your registrar and get every single transfer code and all that stuff you have to do, if you give them the username and password to your registrar, they will do the move for you. It's pretty great. So check out Hover. It's high-quality, no-hassle domain name registration. Again, use promo code ATP for 10% off at hover.com/ATP. Thank you very much to Hover for sponsoring the show.
You know, another use for Hover, Archagon in the chat said, I subscribe to Hover because I'm lonely. And he can talk to, he or she could talk to someone.
8 a.m. to 8 p.m., you cannot be lonely.
He or she finished with, it's like subscribing to a friend.
That's fantastic.
That is pretty awesome. All right, so I'm gonna make a big mistake and ask you to tell me where your Mac Pros are.
It's under my desk right now.
You know what I mean. Where are your trash can Mac Pros? Because isn't it supposed to be before the end of the year, or did I make that up?
I don't know.
Well, they say December. Now, we have to consider, yes, when Apple says just a month for a product, it often comes like the last day of the month. But also, Apple tends to be closed usually. For a large part of the company tends to be closed for the last 2 weeks of December. So I think if it's going to come in December, it's probably going to be within the next week. And my theory is that I think Retina displays might not be totally ruled out for this launch.
Keep up alive.
Yeah.
You're like me with The Last Guardian. They could have them. It could happen.
Hey, 10.10 might have a new file system. So
I am not hoping about that. I'm realistic.
You're secretly hoping.
You know, with your idea of like that you were going to wait and only buy on Retina, that is having a new appeal to me now as I sit here and I think about it. Like, if they came out with them today, would I be rushing to buy one? I'd probably rush to configure them to see the pricing.
Oh, me too.
But I don't know if I would rush to buy them. Maybe you and I will hold strong together and just say, nope, we're not buying trash cans until we can get a Retina display with it. Because I am not buying a Dell. I don't even know how you sit in front of those Dell displays or whatever you got at your setup there. I'm not buying a Dell display.
Oh, I have moved on from my mediocre Dell displays. Now I have a mediocre HP display.
Some ugly black thing. I know.
It's really bad, actually. It has transformer whine, and it's
I think it's inverter whine, actually.
But whatever it is, it has a high pitched whine that occasionally. It's not even regular. It's occasional, and it's really obnoxious. And the signaling interface to it is, or either its signaling interface or my Mac Pro is the video card is buggy in some way, so that mini display port no longer works reliably. The picture will just cut out after a while. I've tried different cables. They're out. So now I'm using DVI, which is a giant, thick cable running behind my computer. And if I move my feet slightly the wrong way, the screen flickers or turns off because something is like slightly on the edge of being connected somewhere within the cable or the two connectors. So I'm just like, I've decided that I really kind of can't and shouldn't buy the new Mac Pro as long as I'm using this monitor, because I'll have to involve another adapter in that chain, because it'll have only mini display ports, or Thunderbolt. So I'll have to have the adapter to this flaky cable, to this flaky monitor, and God knows, if that'll even work or if that'll have problems. So that's yet another reason why I should wait until a Retina display before buying this thing.
I was not excited by the whatever those rumors were of like a Dell 24-inch Retina-ish display, because what would you call it? Logical resolution. Like once you go in high DPI mode, the resolution was too low. Despite the fact, it's also an ugly monitor and
Well, hold on. The resolution was too low on the big one, but on the 23-inch or 24-inch one, it's exactly right.
What was the logical resolution?
1920 by 1200. Or by 1080, sorry.
No, I gotta go bigger than that. I can't stand being stuck in that. I've been stuck in 1920 by 1200 since, I guess, the 22-inch right. Apple Cinema display. And I need bigger. My wife has a 27-inch, and it's not that much bigger in terms of resolution, but it's bigger enough. I cannot be a 1920 by 1200 anymore.
Well, two things. One, for all of Tumblr, I used two 24-inch monitors. So I had two side-by-side monitors of that resolution. Now I have one big 30-inch, and I like the 30-inch better, but not by a massive margin. It's not that different. The 24s give you, I believe, actually more real estate, but the 30, of course, is a little more useful for it because you can have one giant window if you really want to. So I'd say it's kind of a toss-up between the two. Having two 24s or having one 30 or 27 is roughly the same amount of usefulness.
I'm monitor monogamous.
Well, I do like having the one big one because it makes the desk arrangement a lot easier. Like, I can fit my speakers on my desk, and I, yes, anyway.
not on the on-screen. Yeah, no, I use tons of windows, and the bigger area I have to spread those windows, it's like having a big gigantic desk where you spread all your papers out. That's how I treat my screen. And I have had multiple displays at various points. It's not that I dislike it so much, but I would much rather have one big screen than two, even though the total area of the two might be much greater.
Oh, you're so wrong. You're so wrong. I totally prefer having two screens. Absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, but you're a more recent Windows user. Maybe that's it.
No, who had multiple displays first? I was running two displays back when your PC had CGA graphics and everything was teal and purple. So I don't want to hear about multi-monitors. I've been there and done that. It's just the way I work is better with one monitor.
So the other thing to consider is on the Retina screens, they have those different scaling modes. Now, on the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro, I've used this thing a lot. I've gotten a lot of work done on it. So now I'm pretty comfortable knowing that, you know, the native 2x resolution is, as measured in points, it's 1440 by 900, which is like a step below what you'd expect for a 15-inch laptop. But you can tell the display to run in 1680 by 1050 times 2, and it just scales it to fit the actual physical pixels. And so that's how I use it most of the time, and it works just fine. Like it doesn't look bad. I would say it's perfectly fine. So if they release a 27-inch monitor that only has the logical 1920 by 1080 times 2, which is what these rumors all point to, if they do that resolution at 27 inches, I assume they would offer the same kind of scaling mode where you could simulate the 2560 by 1440 of the real 27-inch now. And I would just do that, and I'm sure at that size and at that distance, I'm sure you wouldn't even be able to tell the difference.
I don't know. Non-native res is impressive that it looks as good as it does on the 15-inch, but I don't want that on my desktop. I'll know it's there even if I can't see it.
Well, unfortunately, if they're going to go Retina, I think it's almost certain that's how they would do it. I think they would release a 27-inch at 3840 by whatever, like at double 25 or double 1920 by 1080.
Well, I mean, I keep coming back to the resolution of those desktop images that are included in Mavericks. They are on the nose exactly four times the number of pixels is on the existing 27-inch display. And I can't think that's a coincidence. Like, why would you do it?
I think you're right. However, the way that the Retina MacBook Pro scales it is it renders its own virtual resolution at 2x and then downsamples that image to fit the physical pixels. So if the highest virtual resolution it offered was double 2560 by 1440, it would need a wallpaper that size to be native, and then it would scale it down to 3840 by whatever.
No, the whole rest of the screen isn't like that. They just would scale it up to fit the double res, and then they would scale it back down. It's the same thing that they do with any other drawing. It doesn't fill the screen entirely. I have to think that they're going for, I mean, maybe not. Maybe the first one will be that kind of scale thing, but I don't like that. Who wants to run non-native res? It's gross.
I'm telling you, on my 15-inch Retina, I've run it all the time, and you can't even tell.
I've seen it. It does look impressively good. It looks nice enough that I wouldn't mind running it like that on a laptop, which is like a compromised machine. But on a desktop where I've got this gigantic thing with this amazing GPU power, like, what's the point of it if I can't have... You know, that's the whole reason you're buying this thing with all this power is I want to have actual real native Retina desktop display. Maybe I can't afford that this year. Maybe they come out with it and it's $4,000. Fine, I'll wait. You know, and maybe I'll have to buy one of those non-native res ones in between to get through. But out there in my future is 4x the 27-inch display native.
So here's a question that will probably come up then. Suppose they launch the monitor I think they're going to launch, which is 3840 at 27 inches. So it's going to be, you know, you'd have to scale it up to get that kind of real estate. Do you buy it and just be upset about it and angry for a few years? Or do you hold back and still use 1X monitors with the new Mac Pro? Or do you not buy either? Do you not buy the new Mac Pro and you don't buy the new monitor until it has the resolution you want, which might never happen?
Oh, it will happen. It's, you know, of course it will happen eventually. It's just a question of how long. I would seriously consider buying, trying to get like fire sale prices on the existing 27-inch and just running 1X for a few more years.
Oh man, see, I would so much rather run scaled 2X than run real 1X.
And it wouldn't be because of the non-native thing. It would just be because the logical resolution of the 1X 27-inch would be higher. You know what I mean? Like the real estate, I'm trading the ability to have more space on my desk to spread my crap out for that crap looking, you know, super sharp. I would have to see like what 1920 by logical resolution of like if it's 1080 in the short dimension, that's, I would want it to be at least 1200, because I'm not going to go down. I'm not going to go from 1920 by 1200, which is what I'm looking at now, logical resolution, to a lower logical resolution.
Like an animal?
Well, that's part of the problem that I've, well, part of the way I've justified not getting a Retina MacBook Pro is, since I have the old school high-res anti-glare MacBook Pro, what is this running at?
Let me 1680 see. 1680
by 1050. Yep, 1680 by 1050. And what is your 15 run at if you're in like retinified?
1440 by 900.
Right, that's terrible. That's atrocious.
Well, right, but you can just toggle it.
Yes.
Yeah, but he runs the non-native to get more stuff on the screen.
I do. Let me run. I can tell you that there's this great utility, by the way. I want to plug this. It's called iFriendly. That's I spelled E-Y-E. iFriendly. It's this awesome like $5 thing in the Mac App Store that it lets you assign those resolution scaling things to hotkeys on Retina MacBook Pros, which is really, really nice. So I have like, if you smash all three modifiers and hit up or down arrow, I have that toggle through the modes. It's really, really cool. Yeah, I don't know. I'd be fine with the scale. Like, if that's what I have to do to get Retina in the next 5 years, that's what I'll do.
Wait, but I don't understand, and I'm really being serious. I'm not trying to poke the bear here. If the whole point in a Retina screen is getting everything to look as pretty as it does on iOS, where you've got double the density for the same effective space, doesn't scaling defeat the whole point of that? Yeah, you get a lot more real estate, but isn't that kind of defeating the whole point of the Retina screen in the first place? Or am I just totally missing something here?
It's like 1.5 scale, where things get fuzzy around the edges because it's a non-native resolution, but the pixels are so small that non-native resolution, it doesn't look as blurry as, maybe we all make fun of people who run non-native on their, you know, 800 by 600 iBook, and you know, they would change to non-native res to make everything bigger and it would look terrible. At that size, everything is so small that it just looks a little bit softer. I think Retina is more important to me on an iPad or an iPhone, because I think I just hold it closer to my face that I could see the pixels if they were there. On a desktop, I mean, because I'm using it for work and stuff, I really want more space to move stuff around. And I also want it to be Retina. Like, I want everything. That if I have to trade one for the other, I really have to see what the logical res is and just, like, stare at it for a while in the store and see, could I tolerate using this at a non-native res in the sort of 1.5x mode? I don't know.
So this is kind of like one of those computer philosophy things. It's like, you're still running hard drives on your desktop, right?
At home, yeah.
So there were a lot of people that refused to use SSDs and might still because they were waiting until they could just buy like a 2 terabyte one for $300, something like that, which actually we're not that far off from. But for years, it's like you had these people who were crazy like me who would buy a small SSD and then a big hard drive and jump through the hoops you need to make that be reasonably good just because it was so good to even have an SSD at all that it was worth the kind of hack to get it earlier than when you can go all SSD. Where, you know, so now I wonder if that's going to be like you with Retina. Like, you seem like the kind of person, like, you will, on principle, you will wait and not get this until you can, you know, have the exact resolution you want. Whereas I will jump in sooner and I'm willing to tolerate a little bit of hackiness to get this massive, what I perceive as a massive upgrade that I really want very badly earlier.
But I really want the extra real estate almost as badly as the Retina. Like, that's the problem. Like, the thing that will change my life the most will be having more room on my screen to put stuff. And I was hoping not to have to go backwards and hoping, you know, that to get Retina, I wouldn't have to sacrifice space. I would also get a small bump in space or whatever. So that's the other change that I'm looking for. And for the SSD hard drive thing, Fusion Drive nicely takes care of that. I don't think there's an equivalent, though, of Fusion Drive, unless it's that 1.5x mode. But Fusion Drive has almost none of the disadvantages of spinning disks and almost all the advantages of Retina, and I'm not sure that's true of the non-native res Retina screen. I guess it also depends on how dense it is, because I think the 15-inch MacBook Air is going to end up being more dots per inch, native dots per inch, than the Retina desktop display. So it might look different than your laptop does in non-native.
That's actually a good point. Yeah, I bet you're right about that. I hadn't considered that, but I'm also sitting much further away. But you are right that I think it will be significantly lower density, because the Retina MacBook Pro is already 2880 by whatever. So it's already like at 15 inches. It's most of that resolution to 4K. It's like, you know, 3/4 of the horizontal resolution. So yeah, maybe.
If we learned anything from the past couple of years, it's that waiting for Apple to rev its displays is like technology version of the crying game. Not know Not in the way you think. Because I just, so many of my past Mac purchases have been like, either based on, well, surely they'll update the displays, or I shouldn't buy a display now because this display is really old and surely they'll revise it soon. And you just wait and you wait. And it's just sadness all around waiting for them. I don't know why they take so long to revise their displays, but they do. And we should just expect it. And now who knows how long it will be before they pair a display worthy of their black trash cans.
But there was that one exception where when they released the first 27-inch iMac, that was like a revolution in displays for that time, where like at the time you could get 30-inch displays for over $2,000, or you could get a 27-inch iMac with a better quality, more dense panel of the same resolution with a free computer stuck to the back of it for like $1,500. And they were the first ones to have those panels in any kind of quantity. And for a long time, the only way to get that panel was to buy an iMac.
That's what I'm saying. They didn't put them. They're like, oh, where's the monitor that's just like that, but without the iMac attached? What do you mean it doesn't exist?
Right. But so like, I'm hoping they pull something like that with Retina. You know, obviously,
they'll attach it to the new Mac Pro. just glue the garbage can to the back of the monitor.
Well, it would almost certainly require Thunderbolt 2, and so you can pretty much only use the new Retina MacBook Pro and the new Mac Pro, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, obviously, you know, we've talked about this before. At least I've talked about this endlessly every episode. We've talked a lot about how, like, all the pieces are in place. It's very obvious that they're planning for a Thunderbolt 2 display that will be Retina, that will work only with the new MacBook Pro and Mac Pro. The only question is when that's going to be available and whether it will be at long shot. For whatever reason, the Mac Pros were seemingly slated to come out earlier in the fall originally, and this feels like a delay to me to come out in quote December, and I could be wrong, but it feels like they were supposed to come out at the November event and they didn't. And all the things they use, the CPUs from Intel are already shipping in volume to everybody else. The GPUs are not new. They're a little customized for Apple, but it's not a new part, so they're probably not having yield issues. So I have to wonder what's the holdup here? What are they holding this back for?
It's the U.S. manufacturing plant getting that yep. up online.
It could be. But I would imagine that happened a long time ago.
Well, like, at this point, it's like, why even bother releasing it this year? Like, I'm sure they'll just release it when it's ready because they don't care. But it's not as if the holiday season has anything to do with Mac Pro purchases, right? So it's like, what kind of company puts a new product up for sale in December? It's nothing to do with the holidays. They'll probably just put it out. If it's ready, they'll ship it, and so what? But it's like, you know, your people going on vacation and stuff. If they wait till January, is the world going to end? No. If it's ready December 16th or whatever that rumor URL just flew through, then fine, they'll ship it then. But, you know, I'm not holding my breath for it. And like I said, even when it comes out, you're not going to buy right away. I'm going to go and fiddle with the configuration right away and then just see what I think.
Well, if it comes out with a Retina display, I will buy it right away. That's the only thing that would make me buy it right away. No question. I'd order it that day. I'd get the 8-core with probably 32 gigs of RAM, 1 terabyte SSD, and probably the mid-range video card. I did some research on the video cards. It looks like the mid-range one is substantially better than the low-end one, and the high-end one is not that much better than the mid-range one. So yeah, I tell you right now, that's the configuration I would get, sight unseen, 8-core, middle video card, 1 terabyte SSD, and 32 gigs of RAM. That's it.
That'll be $6,000, please.
Yeah, probably.
You know, D. Sheehy in the chat asked a very important question. Marco, are you going to choose pick up from Apple's German factory option when you buy your Mac Pro?
Yeah. where do we know where the factory is? Is it like somewhere weird?
I thought it was outside Austin. No?
I could go to Austin. They have good barbecue there.
They have very good barbecue there.
Breakfast tacos. I mean, breakfast tacos are an awesome invention of the world. Like, you gotta. And ever since South by Southwest started sucking, I haven't gone there, and there's, I could visit Dan Benjamin. I could eat barbecue. Let's do it.
You want to road trip it?
No. definitely not doing that.
You don't want to do the. I know John definitely would like to road trip from Boston to Austin.
I think they stop BMWs at the border of Texas.
Well, at least Democrats.
To affix the giant steer horns to the front, and then you're allowed to continue.
Clearly, you haven't spent a lot of time in Texas, John. There's more to Texas.
Well, it's Austin. It's not really Texas.
That's exactly right.
Well, and keep in mind, like, the border of Texas is going to be substantially more rural than Austin.
Oh, man. All right. So I think, are we good? Is that a, yeah, is that a
we
sign?
We should probably cut it off there. Thanks a lot to our sponsors this week, Hover, Igloo, and Squarespace. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin. Because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him. Because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYL. ISS, so that's Casey Liss, MARCOARMENT, Marco Arment, SIRAC, USA Syracuse, it's accidental.
John, what's up with your car? Do you want to talk about that, or do you want to save that for another time?
It's always another time. Let's do it now.
I've got some lots of little items. You know, I'm still on the first tank of gas in that car. The tank of gas.
Seriously?
Came from the dealer.
Wow. You know,
that shows both how little driving I do and also, I guess, how fuel efficient it is. Although I'm not getting great mileage because I'm, you know, stop and go traffic all the time to work. It's much better to go highway miles. But
Now, is that a 5-speed or 6-speed?
6.
But the Civic was 5?
Yeah, this is my first 6-speed car.
I was about to see the BMW is my first 6-speed car.
I have not entered 6th gear yet, though.
I was just about to ask.
I've been in 5th, but not 6th.
Fair enough. So how do you like it?
I'm still babying the car. Like, well, I don't even look in. I haven't finished going through the owner's manual. But like, what do they tell you these days for like engine braking?
Between 1,000 and 1,500 usually.
Yeah, so it's going to be a long time before I can wind this thing out to see what it can do.
Can that wind out?
Oh, it winds out.
Oh, that's terrible. And you know, if you buy an M5 or lease an M5 and get it in Germany, apparently break-in just doesn't matter.
Well, there is break-in, just that the limits are so ridiculous.
It's a leased car. He's not keeping that engine long term.
Anyway, I digress. So tell me, what do you like and what do you not like about the Accord?
I gotta go through this. I have a big list of things I don't like.
Somehow I am not at all surprised by that.
Yeah, I like. So this is my third Honda Accord, and it's my fifth Honda, and I've only ever owned Hondas, although I've driven Mazdas and Volvos and other things that my parents have owned and stuff. And so part of the problem is, like, I guess when you have, you know, multiple kids, you're always comparing it to the past ones. Like, well, in my old Honda, this was like that, and now it's different. And so a lot of the past models have the advantage of familiarity in my mind. And I imagine a lot of my complaints about the new one will fade as I become more familiar with it. In fact, after only driving it for a few weeks or whatever, had it now, I've seen that start to happen where the things that seem weird at first, you just kind of start getting used to. And you realize it wasn't that it was worse. It was just different than the car you're used to. Because a lot of the things that about driving cars are like sense memory of like where things are and how things feel inside the car and how the car moves and everything. And it feels weird and alien at first, but then eventually you start settling in, you start knowing where everything is. But some things are clearly regressions from past Hondas, and that's just such a shame.
Such as?
Well, so let's start with the key fob.
Oh, is it massive like all the modern ones?
They have been getting bigger, right? But in exchange, like, you know, the first Accord I got was the first car that had something on the key fob where you could press a button to unlock the doors, and that's good. I like that feature, right? But it's big. I would obviously you'd prefer it to be like the BMW magical little thing where there's no key part, it's just the fob, and you have little buttons, but you know, that's not the kind of car this is.
That being said, the BMW one is, in my opinion, way too big.
Oh, yours is enormous compared to mine, and yes, I'm talking about key fobs.
Well, the F30, the new 3 Series is the same size as the one I have, so for reference.
It's, oh, really?
And they get bigger. They keep getting bigger.
Yeah, I don't understand why they're so big. Is it like battery life or something?
I have no idea.
So, genuine question though, John, your key situation in the Accord, it is not a proximity key, and you actually do have to insert a metal object into the steering column in order to start the car.
Yeah, and that was one of the, speaking of things that like seem weird at first, but you start to get used to this. And I don't know why they change things like this, but when you have a metal key that goes into a slot to start your car, the angle that slot is something you may not think about until it changes. So all the other Hondas that we had, the angle was, I don't know what angle it is, but I just kind of know, like, when you grab the key in your hand and you reach around the side of the steering wheel to stick it in the slot, you kind of know what angle you have to put it at. And it's a more vertical angle. And in this new Accord, it's much closer to horizontal, which is very weird to do, you know, like the twisting the key. But that's not my complaint about the fob. My complaint about the fob is the old one had three buttons on it in a triangle type arrangement. And the buttons were two different sizes, two different textures. One was concave, one was convex, one had a ring with little studs around it. If you felt that thing in your pocket, you could tell of those three buttons. They were differentiated in every way you could differentiate them, except for they were all circles. It was way easier to fish around there and feel, this is unlocked, this is locked, this is open the trunk, right? You could feel it. The new fob is like a rectangle cut into thirds. And the thing that divides it into thirds is at the same level as everything else. So it just feels like one big, smooth, continuous rectangle. And you have to kind of feel your way along and go, okay, the middle one is unlocked, and the top one is locked, and the bottom one, which is a little bit concave, is like open the trunk or whatever. And so it's so hard to feel around in your pocket to find the unlock button for that thing. You always have to end up taking it out or really concentrating on feeling where that little ridge is, and that's a regression. I don't know why you would take a design where you had three distinct, widely separated buttons in a triangle pattern that have different textures and make one button that's sliced into three parts. Bad. There's another one in the minor complaint department. These are all minor, I guess. This is not really entirely Honda's fault, but kind of their fault. So, you know about NHTSA, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration?
I've heard of it.
Is that how you say it?
Yeah, well, that's all. Yeah, my first job was at Car Talk, and we did the stuff with NHTSA data. I don't know if that's how you say it. That's how I say it. That's how everyone at Car Talk said it.
That's fair. That's authoritative.
Well, not the show, the website, so we could have all just been saying it wrong. But anyway, it's like GIF. Anyway, NHTSA has new requirements for headrests. Not new, but like new since last time I bought a car 11 years ago or whatever, that limits the distance between the back of your head and the headrest, like, because they found that like there was less injury if that distance was smaller. And so the new rules are that to accommodate people sitting in the weird positions they sit in, the headrests have to be closer to your head. And sure enough, in this new Accord, if you were looking at the seat back, and if the seat back was up like perpendicular to the ground, which it never is because no one sits bolt upright in their seat, but if you were to put it like that, the headrest is tilted forward, way forward, to try to minimize the distance between your head and the headrest. So much so that if you actually had the seat in a right angle, which again, nobody ever does, you could, like, this headrest would be shoving your head down. And what people actually do is they tilt the seat way back, and at that point, then the headrest starts to become closer to vertical. But it is a way different experience of the headrest. It looks like the headrest is like reaching back and hitting your head, and you're like, stop, leave me alone. You want the headrest to go back. And it's, if you Google for like 2014 Honda Accord headrest complaints, you'll find people complaining about this. And it's partially Honda's fault for making a headrest that's so far forward like that, and it's not adjustable or whatever, I guess. But it's, I think they're doing it to comply with regulations, that the new regulations are that you have to have a smaller distance between your head and the headrest. This is one of those things I'm kind of getting used to. Once you realize that it's kind of there, it actually fits my head a little bit better than the old headrest when it's adjusted correctly. But it is closer than I think it needs to be, because I would like to have my seat a little bit more upright than I actually do, but I have to tilt it back just to get a reasonable, so the headrest doesn't poke me in the back of the head constantly. I guess one more before we get off this topic, because I have a very long list, and we should come back to it each week and revisit things that you don't like. The stalks, you know, the stalks for like the blinkers and the wipers and everything. I can't tell for sure without actually seeing an Accord with flappy paddles, because they do have like, I'm pretty sure they have Accords with flappy paddles. I think they put the flappy paddles on like the CVT version. It's some ungodly transmission that I don't even want to think about. But anyway.
How does that even make sense? There's not even gears.
It doesn't make any sense. But they do it. Tons of car companies do this. They put CVTs in them because they're cheap and everything, and they also put flappy paddles on them just to make people have fun flapping and make them feel like they have expensive stuff. But my theory is that the stalks are way higher than they used to be. Like, you know, instead of being exactly horizontal, they're up on an angle, like 45 degrees. And I think they're way higher and actually mounted higher on the steering column to make room for the flappy paddles that I don't have in my car. So when I go for the stalks with my fingers, you know, reach around from behind the rim of the steering wheel to reach where the stalks are, they're way higher than I expect them to be, because on all my other Hondas, they were lower down. It could be that they just Honda decided the stalks should be higher up and they're just higher up in all their cars. But my theory is that the empty space below them where I have nothing is where the flappy paddles would go, and they didn't want to make two versions of the steering column with stalks in different positions. So that's a little bit annoying.
But overall, you still do like the car.
I have like a list of 80 more complaints, but I think that's enough for today. But yeah, so far, car's been treating me well. I've been trying to keep it in the garage to see how long I can go acorn dent free.
Nice.
And so far, so good there. No scratches, no dings. It's getting a little bit dirty, but you know. Still, when I walk up to it in the parking lot, I'm still excited to see it with its big shiny wheels and its undented bodywork.
It's the little things.
Get into it and it's leather wrapped steering wheel, which is nice, even though it's not heated, and play with all my various AV connections. And I'm getting into a good rhythm with the iPods that I connect. I connect my shuffle to it a lot to listen to podcasts on it. And then I take the shuffle out of the car with me, you know, so I can listen on my way up the stairs out of the parking garage and everything. So that's working out pretty well. And one of my iPods has a permanent home in the car connected to the actual iPod connector with the, you know, the integration with the steering wheel controls and everything. That's what I use to listen to music. So it's going pretty well.
You're like the worst friend to have when thinking about beta testing a podcast app.
I gotta have the physical buttons. I cannot look at a screen to pause the podcast. And why do I have to pause the podcast? Because the kids are asking me a question. Because my wife is calling me. Because something, you know, I want to be able to just reach a button without looking and pause. And I could do that with steering wheel controls, and I can do that with an iPod shuffle. Can't do it with an iOS iPod app.
Well, you can with a clicker, if you have the headphone clicker.
Yeah, but I'm wearing headphones. It's going over the speakers in the car. It's the whole point of the integration. I want to have sound in the car.
So you use the wheel controls. What's wrong with that?
Wheel controls can't pause.
Can't you just tap the off button to pause?
No, we went through this on Twitter, didn't we?
Yeah.
I mean, even just like queuing up the podcast. Like I like the shuffle. Again, because I want to listen to it. I want to listen to it when I'm getting ready in the morning, when I'm getting out of my car, going out of the parking garage, going up the stairs to the building, and on the way back down. You wouldn't think that would make a difference, but that's, you know, 5-10 minutes a day when I want to have the podcast with me.
That's fair.
So, and during that time, I also don't want to be fumbling with something in my pocket or accidentally hitting. It's going to be difficult to get me to use an iOS iPod podcast application. If Apple would just stop making the shuffle, and then that'll do it.
And what do the kids think? Do they even have an opinion?
I don't think they care.
Are they allowed in the car?
They know about new car smell. They said, "What's that smell? This is the first new car smell." You know, so they're excited.
Oh yeah, because they're both a lot younger than your previous car.
Oh wow, that's true.
They were too young when we got the 2006 Accord. They were, you know, alive, but they were too young to care about that. I'm excited because now they're both old enough and big enough to only be in boosters. They don't have to be in like the big seats that destroy your car.
Nice.
And so hopefully the seats in this car will not be destroyed by, you know, the gigantic car seat strapping mechanisms that destroy cars.
For whatever it's worth, so far I've gotten away okay with that. Like, for, I don't know if it, like, I have like this one like little pad, this little skinny like pad that sits between the two, but for the most part, like, I have those things tight as hell, and I've been fine.
Well, leather is probably more durable than cloth in terms of resisting the compression and everything. And also, you're not supposed to have anything under the car seat. If you go to the local fire department, they'll yell at you about that.
The cop who installed the first one didn't complain about the thing I had, because you could still get it so ridiculously tight that, like, if you, like, shake the top, it doesn't even budge. Like, it's, like, it's that tight, you know? So, like, it's so locked down that I don't think anybody could really complain about it.
Is he still rear facing?
Yeah, we're to the point now where he doesn't need to be rear facing, but like the current wisdom is that, which makes sense, is that you should rear face pretty much until they can't fit rear facing anymore. Like until like their knees are at their chin rear facing, then you have to turn it around.
You're not supposed to get it too long because their little legs can get caught between the seat and the thing. So there is a leg length limit for rear facing. But yeah, the real seat destruction doesn't happen until you go front facing. You'll see when you get like a gigantic.
Right, when they can kick the back of the.
That's part of it. Yes, they get their stupid feet all over the back of your seats. But no, the ones the big seats that strap in end up just pressing down into the foam of your seat, and like four points of wherever the seat hits the car seat hits your seats, that really destroys it, because you have to crank it down with the seatbelt, and it's not like the rear facing has the advantage of kind of being pulled into the little wedge of your seat, like you're taking the car seat and pulling that thing into the wedge of the seat, whereas the front facing one has got to kind of be pulled down into the seat. You'll see when you get one there, and plus they weigh more and they have more scratchy things, and there's a much heavier kid sitting in them.
Well, the one I have now is both, that you can reverse it. But, I mean, there's no seatbelt involved anymore. Now it's all latch.
Well, yeah. What model do you have? I hate latch. What model do you have?
Give me a second. I couldn't even tell you.
Tiff would know.
It's, Give me a second. Talk about something else with Casey for 2 minutes while I'm looking up on Amazon.
going through your order history.
Yeah.
All right, I'll pull out another complaint. The pedals are too close in the Accord.
It's the Britax Marathon 70G3.
Marathon. All right, I know that one.
Yeah, it's pretty. The one we had before for the infant car seat we had was the Graco, whatever snug ride, whatever. It was a piece of crap. Like it was every time I had to remove or mount that car seat, I wanted to burn down the world. It was just a total piece of crap. Like the latch, horrible. The Britax Marathon has been fantastic so far. It's night and day difference in like installation, quality, ease of use, massive difference.
I don't know if we had a marathon. I think we might have had another similar model, but this is still like a little kid seat. Once you get the big kid seats are just brutal. Like if you can look at the part that contacts the bottom, that little sort of the foot of the thing, that is a much gentler foot than the big ones to start just, yeah. And the other thing is the food. Oh God, the food that it grinds into the thing that's underneath it as they throw their food out, and then it goes underneath there, and then the sticky candy gets in there, and then the seat is grinding it into the. It's disgusting. Kids are disgusting. So no, I'm really excited about that. I don't have to have those giant seats in there anymore. No more latch. No more belting the seatbelt in, doing the little clicky ratcheting thing. No more of that.
Just boosters.
Yeah.
So you said you still have the first tank of gas, and presumably the range on one of those is somewhere around 400 miles on a tank?
I think it's less than that. I think it's like 300 and something. It's okay. Small tanks. They put small tanks in them.
So at that rate, if you've had the car, what, 3 or 4 weeks now?
Something like that, yeah.
So if you call it a month, that says it's going to take you another 3 months to just get out of braking.
It's in the honeymoon period. Well, when we go on our summer trip to Long Island, this will be the car we take, so that may be its first long trip.
Because Long Island never has any traffic or anything. You'll be fine.
Well, we don't go the trafficy way.
You sound like somebody from D.C. Yeah, you know, it's the same thing in D.C. Oh, D.C. traffic is terrible. Oh, no, it's not. It's not terrible at all. And so, like, the Hausmans, who I know Marco is friendly with, Stephanie had said, oh, you know, the traffic is fine in D.C. as long as you know where you're going. Oh, no. Just today, she tweets a picture of her on 95 or 495 or God knows what, stopped. Because DC traffic is terrible. And I think Marco was going to say that Long Island's the same way.
Well, and like everyone always thinks they have like their own little secret way that they can go that won't have traffic. And then the problem is there's like, you know, millions of people who all have the same idea. And everyone thinks they have. It's like the AT&T store on iPhone launch.
My way is not secret, but it actually avoids traffic.
Sure.
You just don't go on roads, you go on a boat. If you go from New London to Orient Point, there's no traffic. Hey, I solved the problem. That's what we do when we go down there. We take the New London ferry to Orient Point. On that boat trip, there is no traffic. I guess there's boat traffic, but they don't get in your way. And then once you go from Orient down to where we stay, you're going in the North Fork. You know, it's not against or with traffic. There's just nobody there. Like, we don't get close to the city. So, yeah, that's how you avoid traffic.
Take boats.
Going down to New London is usually not that bad. It could be a couple. I mean, if we depends on what day we leave. But that'll be enough highway miles to get out. I used to drive around. And then, I mean, it's not terrible. There's always a little bit of traffic around the city. But you would actually end up getting, depending on where you're driving, it's very possible that you could get there faster by driving around than you would by taking a ferry, because the ferry, you got to wait for the ferry to show up, and the ferry is actually kind of slow, but you're not driving during that time, so it's better.
Turns out boats full of cars are slower than cars.
They are, but it feels faster because you get a break, unless you're like me and can't stand boats, but it's a testament to how unwilling I am to drive around, or how unwilling my whole family is to drive around these days, that I'm actually willing to get on a boat, although I dread it every time, but I survive.
Are there any transport methods that you enjoy?
When I'm driving my car, I'm more or less fine with that, but you know, no one likes to be stuck in traffic, I guess. I'm okay with teleportation. Anyone wants to work on that?
I would love to hear John go hypercritical on teleportation. I can only imagine what that would feel like.
Well, I've read too many bad sci-fi stories about the dangers of teleportation that I imagine it wouldn't go well. But
it doesn't seem worth the risk.
Seriously.
I wouldn't go first. Let someone else go first, you know.